Hello and welcome to another of the Sheldrake Vernon Dialogues with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Hi, Rupert.
Hi, Mark.
So we get together and try and have a conversation about something we've been thinking about or have heard about that's interested us, to tease out as we can the subject, and hopefully that inspires your thoughts as well. And today, Rupert, I wanted to ask you about something you just mentioned, which was a new word even to me, and I wonder whether you could tell me something about it and then see where we go, and which is the notion of eco-confession. Now, I've got the sense that it's something to do with living in a time of ecological crisis, but perhaps you can say, you know, more about this idea.
Well, the idea came up when I was talking to a friend in the summer on Cortes Island, Karen Mahon. And Karen Mahon had just become an interfaith minister. She'd been ordained as one. She's also one of Canada's leading ecological activists involved in campaigns to save rainforests, like the Great Bear Rainforest, to stop pipelines through the tar sands and that kind of thing. So she's a very practical woman. And she told me that when people come to visit her, they often start with a kind of confession about, you know, how many tons of carbon they've emitted in their plane ride coming to visit her, and then trying to justify it through, you know, saying, well, this is such an important meeting, I felt it was justified, and then sort of, as it were, confessing about their carbon emissions. And she told me this, she thought of this as sort of slight interruption to the conversation, or at least wanted to get on with it. But actually, when we thought about it, we thought actually this could be something useful because, you know, in Christian services, you start with a confession. And one of the purposes of confessions is to stop you going into denial about something. If you can't confess it, then you have to sort of repress it and you get into a state of denial. And right now, regular church services and where confessions do still occur in this somewhat ritualized form don't really address the ecological problem. I mean, people probably feel that these confessions are mostly about, you know, being impolite to other people or being greedy or, you know, committing adultery or something like that. But actually, every single one of us is taking part in eco-hostile activities. I mean, how many single-use pieces of plastic have we discarded this week? You know, when I go out to fill our recycling bins, it's horrific, the quantity. And we actually try to reduce plastic waste. How many tons do we emit in carbon footprint? One flight to North America and back, you know, say to California or Canada, where I go every year, is 3 or 4 tons of carbon emission. Well, when I did my carbon footprint calculations, just living at home with eco-friendly light bulbs and stuff is about 4 tons per year. Although I try and fly relatively little, my carbon footprints from flights are about 6 tons per year. So for people like you and me, the worst thing we do in terms of carbon emissions is flying and going around the world. And people do it casually. I mean, so I'm going over to Australia for Christmas. You know, I hear these conversations all the time, as if it's just like going walking down the road sort of thing. It's become so commonplace. And in Sweden, Greta Thunberg has tried to raise up this culture of plane shame, an actual flight percentage of air miles travelled by Swedes is actually going down, partly as a result. So the idea of eco-confessions would be actually just thinking about our own activities and how they contribute to this crisis. It's easy for us to bemoan this crisis that's engulfing us all, but we're all part of it, and it's impossible to live in the modern world without being part of it. I mean, it's the simpler when you think in, step back a bit and you look at the way we live, things we take for granted. Just flushing a lavatory In the modern world, which is short of water, England may not be, but many parts of the world are, modern sanitation systems, which involve flushing gallons and gallons of water down a toilet every time you pee, is absurd. I mean, it's just an absurd system, flushing away all the urea that comes out in our urine, about 7 kilograms per year each person is producing. Meanwhile, we flush that away. Meanwhile, we have huge factories creating urea fertilizer to put on agricultural fields from nitrogen in the air and huge amounts of energy required to make it by the Haber-Bosch process. So the slightest thing we do is contributing to this, and we take most of these things for granted. So this idea that came up in conversation with Karen of eco-confessions was one way I thought that we could, you know, become aware. Now, obviously, there's no point plunging us all into deep, impenetrable guilt and gloom, because that's disempowering. So there has to be a way of becoming aware of what we're all doing that can be empowering and helpful in our lives. Now, I was interested to talk to you about it because you're a kind of confessor. I mean, you're a psychotherapist. In some ways, psychotherapy has taken on the role that was traditionally taken in the Roman Catholic Church by confession and confessors. So I wonder what you think of this idea.
Yeah, I mean, it is very fascinating. And in fact, some psychotherapists, notably Susie Orbach, have tried to write about this in relation to the climate crisis, particularly in relation to Extinction Rebellion, and are putting forward the idea that so-called negative feelings are actually a crucial part of a new kind of way of living, because it's only when you undergo the negative feelings, not so they destroy you or make you want to deny them or be distracted from them, because that's the great risk, that you feel something terrible like guilt and then it just sort of paralyzes you. Which of course is very common in the Christian tradition, when people looking at it in that way. But nonetheless, if you can tolerate the negative feelings in order that they can be kind of catalyze a new way of life, they can become a source of inspiration as well as facing reality full on, you might say, by seeing exactly how you engage with the environment as you describe. Then it's possible they might become agents of change. And that's the way you try and do it in psychotherapy. You know, one definition of neurosis is that you prefer a sort of what feels like a manageable set of bad feelings for fear of what would happen if you exposed yourself to the full panoply of feelings in life, that they would overwhelm you. You know, so you, I don't know, you go back, as it were, to see whether the front door is locked several times before you actually leave the house, and because it's better, as it were, to be worried about that one thing that threatens your security than to expose yourself to the full range of possibilities that your security might be under threat, you know, all sorts of ways, actual and imagined. So, you know, we need to be careful not to become neurotics, I think, in this process. It's a key problem, actually. But nonetheless, you know, I mean, you mentioned about plastic, and I understand that one way in which in my household, where we have actually changed the way we behave to some small degree, at least, is in relation to consumption of meat. You know, we had quite a critical moment where actually not so much realizing the impact of particularly, you know, sheep and cows on the environment, but just the meat industry and the way it brutalizes animals. Mm. And we just kind of reached a critical moment where we said, okay, look, we're not going to become strict vegans or strict vegetarians, but we are basically not going to have meat in the house. And we, you know, got a couple of cookbooks and so on, had to re-educate ourselves a bit. But a year or two on, don't even really notice it now. Mm. And occasionally we'll have meat at a restaurant or if it's offered us when we go out. And, you know, that it's a small thing, but I guess if that sort of thing did scale up. Similarly, you know, we have almond milk, which we use for nearly everything. You know, because, again, the impact of cow herds on the environment. So it's not enough to save the planet, but it is maybe a little example, at least, of how being quite horrified actually by a kind of full exposure to the meat industry, did actually lead to some behavioural change at least.
Well, in our household, we have a very similar policy to yours. We don't have meat in the house except once a year. We have a goose or a turkey for Christmas. But we do eat it occasionally when we go out to dinner or in restaurants. And I personally, when I do that, prefer to eat either organically farmed animals where the welfare standards are higher, or animals that have lived free, like pheasants or deer. As opposed to, I mean, what for me is the most horrific is the factory farming, and that's the worst in terms of methane and emissions and environmental, negative environmental impact. So I think a lot of people are doing that. That's why there's been such a big rise in veganism. I mean, now almost every supermarket and restaurant has vegan products, and a few years ago they didn't. They did have vegetarian ones, but it's gone further. So I think that is an example of a lifestyle change as a result of this awareness. But when I first did my carbon footprint, I was very into low energy bulbs, and I got refitted our house with low energy bulbs, made a real point of doing that. But then when I did the carbon footprint, and I realised the low energy bulbs would that would change my impact by about 2%, whereas if I gave up one intercontinental flight, it would make 100% difference to my carbon footprint. It's so massive. So I think in part it involves getting things into perspective, otherwise it can become mere tokenism.
Yeah. I mean, maybe there's another element as well, which I don't know quite how this would make a scale difference, but certainly you see it at the level of individual psychology, which is that often when people are mentally ill, they're very trapped, you might say, in their own world. They can't really, they don't really know how to relate to other people around them. And sometimes this is called paranoid schizoid functioning, but which basically means that you live a very kind of withdrawn and isolated life, and that it's the paranoid bit refers to the fact that when you do sense that, as it were, there's other lives around you, it provokes a paranoid response. You go into essentially a sort of fight or flight mode, and what's required to move beyond that often is in a way, giving up a sense of your own omnipotence, because to feel that you can live a life where you're completely in control of things is to live far too omnipotently. It is to live as if you can control everything. But letting go of that involves what in psychotherapy is called depressive functioning, which basically means recognizing your limits, and in your fantasy life, realizing that you have to expose yourself to the world around you, and that can be troubling or deflating, because you're giving up the fantasy that actually you can control your whole life. But of course, on the other side of the depressive functioning comes the realization that there's actually other lives around you, there are other people around you, and so something like maybe love can come in. Where you are able to relate much more richly and much more fully. And now this happens to individuals, perhaps, who have been seriously ill, or maybe it's just part of our developmental process, actually, that we tend to move from periods of in our life, like when we were very young, where we have fantasies that we're completely in control, because when I'm hungry, I imagine food and food miraculously appears, and we have no idea that it's our mother or father feeding us. And then we realize that we don't actually control our food, and we scream and fight and go through various rages as tiny children, this kind of more depressive mode. But then if we can resurface from the other side of that, we realize there's actually a mother and a father to relate to, and so our world grows. And I just wonder whether part of what is good about encouraging eco-confession would be that it encourages us to kind of give up on some of the fantasies which we share at a cultural level, that we can control the world ad infinitum just through the better use of technology, for example, or developing new technologies. It's going to require a troubling phase, a depressive phase, where we feel that maybe the future we'd all hoped for is not going to materialise, but on the other side might be a future that we never even fully imagined, because by limiting our own control of the world, our own, as it were, slightly omnipotent demands on the world, you know, whereas, as you say, I can fly to Australia tomorrow if I want to, thank you very much. That actually a new kind of reality might grow, a new way of life might grow from it. You know, if the microcosm of our own inner development matches the macrocosm of our cultural development, then maybe that would be the case. And so eco-confession wouldn't just be about dealing with our difficulties now, but actually might become a way of life, might be a path into the future.
Yes, I think that's a very... Yes, I think it could be, actually. You see, I think it could lead to changes in behaviour. I mean, at least in my own case, the awareness of the impact of flying has made me think twice about... I didn't stop doing it. I was very impressed by the fact when Rowan Williams was Archbishop of Canterbury, he spent a whole year without any flights at all, just travelling by train in Europe. He couldn't go to America or Australia or anything. But reducing, becoming aware of it, I think is the first step. And then we can also do things like the last flight I went on. It was a British Airways flight to Italy. And it was a kind of orgy of single-use plastic. They brought a lunch and you know, the tray, with the thing it was on, the containers, the knives, the forks, the glass, a whole lot. Single-use plastic. I mean, a huge quantity from just one flight. I wrote to them about it, you know, saying, you know, this is appalling, and they hadn't replied. But at least if some, there are things that, some, we tiny things we can do like that. But it does involve reimagining the way our whole society works. And not just making Britain carbon neutral by 2050 or whatever the goal is, because we're still exporting our manufacturing to China and other places, so a lot of the pollution and even these data farms, you know, where huge amounts of energy used for bitcoins and for web searches and for YouTube and stuff, we sort of outsourced all that. So even if Britain became carbon neutral, a lot of our activities are simply exporting these things to the rest of the world. I think becoming more aware with sort of like footprint calculations or flow sheets or some, like we do tax returns every year, and you actually have to become aware of these things. Something like that would help to raise our awareness and would help to change our behaviour, I think.
And maybe also it would do something else. Again, the sort of psychotherapist in me wonders whether it would require not just an examination of what we're consuming, but an examination of our desire itself. You know, what do we want from life? And because I think part of the genius of capitalism and the genius of materialism is that it recognises that human beings want more and more and more and more, but it's very successfully channeled it into more and more consumption. You know, so you want your flight and then you want your meal on your flight and you want, you know, to have it here and now immediately, which is the kind of desire behind the orgy of plastic consumption, as you so vividly put it. But if we were to examine our desire through this process of things like eco-confession, we might realise, for example, that our deeper desires aren't actually really very well satisfied by just more and more consumption, and that our desire, as it were, wants just not sort of more and more in a sort of flat sense, but maybe wants more and more in a kind of deep sense. And that part of, say, the appeal of things like meditation, which also are having a kind of cultural renaissance at the same time as we get more and more worried about the environment. And maybe what that is about understanding how people are also wakening up to desire can be satisfied in different ways, say by contemplation. Maybe also, you know, you get into a virtuous spiral where because you were travelling more slowly, maybe even by walking, you know, we've talked about pilgrimage many, many times, but maybe even by walking, you start to realise that there are pleasures, as it were, right in front of you as you walk from the copse into the open field. which you had just not even realised you were there when you were flying right over the top of them, either in a plane or on a train. So I don't know, maybe that is a bit too much to hope for, but I certainly, I mean, again, at a purely confessional level, you know, I realise how much I had lost contact with the countryside around me, which I think I must have had as a child, you know, even 30 or 40 years ago, because we did play in the woods. I'd lost that by sort of madly travelling around on trains and planes, or even sort of cycling, which I do more and more. There's something tremendous about rediscovering just what, how much the spirit of a place can change in just a few minutes, which you get with walking. So this is speaking to a sort of, speaking to my desires, to come back to my main point, speaking to my desires, but realizing that maybe my desires can be satisfied in very, very different ways, and not just cajoled on this kind of capitalist treadmill that consumes more and more and more in a desperate attempt to please them.
Yes. Well, I suppose one way of doing that would be, you know, positive psychology is the study of what makes people happy and what increases well-being. And the findings of positive psychology, which I discuss in my book, Science and Spiritual Practices and Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, you know, include the practice of gratitude. So just by making a list every day of things for which one is grateful, you know, people become happier. I do myself. I find, you know, so there are certain lifestyle things or practice, spiritual practices, which increase life satisfaction at no cost to the environment, and indeed at no cost to oneself either, in terms of monetary expenditure or carbon footprint. And it's a measurably successful way of people making people feel more connected, happier, more satisfied. So part of it might be the promotion of spiritual practices, or at least positive psychology practices, which increase the sense of satisfaction and connection, and and make us all less vulnerable to the blandishments of materialist advertising and consumerism.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can see that. I the psychoanalyst in me, though, also wants to complement that with the fact that tragedy and crisis and loss and experiences of death, I think, are part of life too. And we're going to see more and more of that, I think, over the next years. And developing the capacity to tolerate that, to undergo the suffering, really, or witnessing the suffering in others, without running in the opposite direction, without, in a way, even wanting it to be over too quickly, if I can dare to put it like that. And because I think, again, spiritual traditions all suggest, you know, that dark nights of the soul sort of have to be undergone in order for really something new to be born, to be resurrected, for real transformation to take place. And certainly, again, I don't know quite really what this means at a cultural level, and I'm very, you know, I feel very cautious saying it, because it could well be it's the suffering of millions of people. On a scale, you know, which is really hard to contemplate, especially when it might be elsewhere, because we live in a fairly wealthy part of the world. So look, I partly even regret having said what I said, but nonetheless I did. But it is also true at the same time that part of what happens in psychotherapy is you go and see someone who has gone through that crisis, either because it precipitated in their own life and they recovered through therapy, or that the training, the psychotherapy training itself, in a way induces a crisis that you then go through, so that you can know that it can be survived, and you can sit with someone, accompany them as they're going through their crisis, and as Donald Winnicott put it, be with them as they're going to pieces, but stopping them completely falling apart. And so there is something very true, I think, about facing you know, the really negative feelings, the dark thoughts in something like, say, eco-confession, as you say, that actually enables us to stay with what might unfold over the next few years. And that and try and keep a mind about it, so we keep thinking, keep trying to work out, you know, how to react to it, how to relate to it, rather than getting lost in kind of panics, or, you know, what might well happen to warfare, you know, out and out destruction and so on, which is not an unlikely scenario we'd face as well, I think.
No, I mean, the first thing that would happen if warfare broke out would be some kind of cyber war. And, you know, it's relatively easy for cyber warfare people to just take out the whole internet. And, you know, now most people pay for everything by card. So the entire economy could be crippled in a matter of minutes with a skillful cyber attack. That would be just wave first phase. That would be the opening salvos of a new kind of war. It would make everyone instantly aware of how totally dependent we've become on these technologies that, in you know, electronic money, internet, you know, smartphones, all these things could just disappear very quickly. Actually, a breakdown of this technology in a non-warfare context, maybe because of a solar flare or something like that, could be hugely educational for us all, to show how totally dependent we've become on these things. So I think these things could help in raising our awareness. But obviously, as you say, you don't want to get to the point of total disempowering gloom and depression, because people are deeply depressed and not very effective at anything much until they've got out of the depression.
Yeah, I mean, one final thought which I have, again, a sort of psychotherapy thought, is that you need to have a place in life for the dark times, times of feeling depressed, and in particular, you need to have a place in life for death, because that is part of life. And when that's not given a place, actually, then that's when people become neurotic and scared of death and so on. The spiritual side of me feels that another really important part of what we need to recover is a sense that, the material side of life is just one aspect of life. And it's maybe through the material world that a spiritual dynamic can be felt and known, the kind of inner life of all things. And while sometimes this is sneered at, as if what you're advocating is kind of pie in the sky when you die. And that is a risk, you know, as if this life doesn't really matter because it's going to be all right in the next life. I'm not saying that. But there is something, I think, about knowing there's more to life than just the material reality that actually can make you less possessive of your material things. It can make you, as it were, happy with less material things, because you know there's more to life than just the sort of stuff you've got or the stuff you can control. William Blake put it rather beautifully when he said, he who binds to himself the joy does the limited life destroy. He who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. And there's something about being less possessive with our material stuff that actually opens up the kind of spiritual reality that's around us. So I again feel somehow awakening to the more than the material, moving beyond the material conception of things, is going to be really important, not just to sort of console us when we're facing things like death, and being able to give a place to death in life, but also because it might actually, again, create a kind of virtuous spiral where we want less of the material stuff, because our desire is reorientated once more to spiritual realities, which of course is what most humans before the modern period have done anyway. And when you look back to the medieval world or to indigenous cultures and so on, they're much more alert to living in relation to spiritual realities. So that might be another really important facet of this whole confession that we have to kind of go through, examination of our desires, giving up on things, facing what feels like a limitation of life.
Yes, absolutely. And part of the thing that I'd certainly include in my confession in a more general cultural sense, not as a personal responsibility, but a collective one, is the way we, through colonialism, imperialism, neoliberalism, and indeed Christian missionary activity, have actually ignored these other traditions in the world, treated them as contemptuously childish, you know, backward, superstitious, and now swamped, or tried to swamp them out with smartphones and social media and all the modern things that we have in the Western world. So just when we most need these other voices, we're actually silencing them, as in the Amazon and elsewhere. So that again is part of our collective activity. I mean, part of my eco-confession would be buying things that may have furthered the activities of deforestation in the Amazon or in Borneo, or, you know, through having palm oil in products and that kind of thing. I mean, we're all part of a vast consumer neoliberal system which is destroying the planet, and it's very hard to detach oneself from it. So we're all in part responsible.
But there are also ways that perhaps we can listen beyond just the pure consumption of stuff from the Amazon, as it were, to regain
yes.
that kind of lost wisdom, as you're
well,
saying
that's,
too.
That's one of the points, and it comes back to a point we've often discussed about regaining a kind of sense of spiritual connection, returning to a sense of greater connection with the living world around us.
Yeah, I mean, I feel completely convinced that a sort of re-enchantment, a sort of recovery of spiritual reality is a really fundamental part of this. It's maybe a hard part of it, because it's not just about saying we need to do this or develop a new technology. But I think if doing things in the new technology is going to be sustainable, it's going to have to be, you know, it's going to be a transformation of our way of life. That seems to me to be completely clear. And transforming
yes.
it in the sense that is expanding and growing, but in a spiritual direction, that seems to me to go with the current of human desire, rather than to feel that we've got to sort of try and shut things down, which never actually works, because it just, as again, to use a psychotherapeutic idea, the repressed just returns, and probably in worse forms.
I think what you've just said expresses the vision we share, and which is the basis of many of our conversations, in fact.
Yeah.